Welcome to the Racquetball Show podcast. On this episode, I have on the Peck brothers, Dave and Greg Peck. These guys were an awesome interview, and I really enjoyed talking to them, and I know that you will too. Also, you'll notice that there is no instructional segment in this podcast, and that is for a couple reasons. One, because I've been busy, slash, it wasn't a priority, slash, I was lazy. And the other reason is that Dave and Greg are a couple of amazing high-level coaches themselves, and they offered a lot of racquetball advice, so I'm sure that you'll glean a ton of instructional value just from listening to them talk, more than I'm sure you could get from me in the instructional segments, although hopefully you are gleaning some from those as well. Great. Well, I hope you enjoy this episode 13 of the Racquetball Show podcast.
I will be the greatest player to ever play the game.
Anybody who won't die for it
shouldn't be playing.
Get that ball. Get the ball.
I wanted to take a quick moment to plug one of my sponsors, Gearbox Racquetball. Now, full disclosure, Gearbox sponsors me as a player, so of course, you know, sponsoring me on this podcast makes total sense, and I wouldn't sponsor any other brand, but I choose Gearbox for a reason. I think they're a fantastic brand. They provide top-of-the-line racquetball equipment, really anything you need, rackets, eye guards, gloves, bags, and all the other accessories that you might need. And as a listener of this podcast, I'm sure you guys already know that. You're aware of all the brands out there because probably if you're listening to this, you're pretty darn into racquetball. So I just wanted to take a moment to plug Gearbox because I think they not only provide awesome products, but they do an awesome job of promoting racquetball, and they have amazing customer service, and everyone you interact with on the Gearbox team is an awesome person. At least that's what I've found in my experience. So if you're in the market for racquetball equipment, I would advise that you check out Gearbox. You can check them out at gearboxsports.com. Okay, so I'm here with the Peck brothers, Dave and Greg Peck. Dave was, in 1982, the number one player. He's a Hall of Famer in racquetball. He's coached players such as Cliff Swain, his brother Greg, who's here with us, and Mike Guidry. And I'm here with Greg as well, who was the 1981 Rookie of the Year. He won a variety of junior championships. He was the 85 Player of the Year and national champion in 1985. So thanks for joining me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
With you, Dylan.
So one of the first things I wanted to get into is what would you say is one of the major differences between racquetball back in the day when you guys were playing versus where it's at now?
I got that one. Basically, when we started playing ball, when I started playing ball, and Greg too, racquetball was the sport for fitness, okay? So you didn't have the life cycles. You didn't have all the fitness equipment and things like that. You had racquetball clubs, and people would go out, and that was their way of getting a really great workout in across the board, indoors. And whereas today, what's transpired is you have the huge clubs with all the fitness equipment and all those things. And basically, there are many avenues for people to work out. Whereas in those days, when I was first started off, racquetball was the way to get a great workout in and to get into good shape as far as stuff goes.
Yeah, the other thing too, Dylan, I think, are you talking also specifically as to the differences between how racquetball is played at a professional level?
Sure.
versus now? Yeah, so I mean, I think you see, you know, it's like most sports, technology has sped up the game from a serve standpoint. You know, you see these top players are hitting incredible serves, and you know, it used to be when we played, the ball, you didn't have as many aces, and the ball was being put in play a lot more. And so that's one of the biggest differences. You know, I remember playing Cliff when he got really, really good and started getting on a roll. And I remember telling Dave, you know, you're talking about really, you know, 5 or 6 points a game sometimes that you're either aced or you're just so on the defensive that he's winning those points. So it really, you know, puts a premium on the serve, and it puts a premium on the service returning and getting the ball back into play. And I think you're seeing that now with, I mean, Kane has such a great serve, and he's so well-rounded that, you know, a lot of times you're just on the defense from the get-go. Yeah. So you don't see a whole – you don't see as many ceiling balls. You know, these days people are ripping it. And I think that, you know, what transitioned from, you know, me taking my backhands flat and bringing it down and taking that ceiling ball from a defensive position into an offensive side of things is the new norm now too. You don't see the top players playing much ceiling ball games. They prefer to just go ahead and shoot it, you know, from deep back court, and because they're hitting the ball so much harder. So I think that's one of the biggest differences. And then I would say the other thing that was a big difference, and Dave, you can speak to this too, because it used to be, you know, you play to win a tournament, you'd have to play 5 matches, and the tournament was extremely deep as far as talent goes. So let's say you played a tournament in California. I mean, you're playing, you know, you might, and at that time, Dave and I were ranked in the top 8. You might play a qualifier, but that qualifier was Ed Andrews, Steve Lerner. You know, it was just some Brian Hawks.
Egan, in a way. Egan, yeah, was, yeah. Egan,
you know, so what ended up happening is by the time you got to the quarters and the semis, you were pretty beat up. And then at that point, you're playing Mike Yellen or Marty Hogan, or you're playing into Dave. I mean, so the depth of the talent pool in the 80s and, you know, what they consider the heyday, I think that's one of the biggest differences too. I'm not saying that, you know, there's a lot of good players right now, but I'm talking about, you know, there were 32 players that all 32 from the first round could be in the quarters or semis at any given event. So Dave, you can speak to that a little bit more, because you had to go through the qualifying too early on.
In case in point, when I was coming up, I had to play 3 qualifying matches just to get into the round of 32.
Yeah, so you would play an incredibly tough 3 qualifying matches on Wednesday. You're exhausted, and then you play into Rich. I remember Dave playing into Rich Wagner through qualifying, who at that time was ranked number 2 in the world. So you had to beat a top player to get a top 16 ranking.
Yeah,
that sounds exciting and cool. And yeah, so part of this interview for me will be a lot of, you know, educating a younger player who's not aware of some of the older styles and how the game used to be. But in
those older styles,
yeah,
you know, still see, I contend that the ability to keep the ball up high and control it up there, watching players, sure, they can bring it down. But the speed in which the guys can go attack the ball, you know, to me, it's about making sure that if you can control that, keep it out of their strength, you can win matches against those kind of players. And I just don't see a lot of players that have that type of control and the ability to negate the power of a game. Now, Kane is one of those that he can sit there and shift over to a high lob nick, things like that, but it's about retrieving and re-killing once the ball comes down. And so, you know, to me, I see these younger players, and it's one speed. Mm. And what the one speed is all good if you're playing somebody that likes that speed, but if to me, I always, when I played a rabbit or the high-speed RPM, I always slowed the tempo down, changed it up, and took them out of their game as best I could, whereas I don't see a lot of that. I just see one speed. Just walk up there, hit it as hard as they can, run and go chase it down, re-kill, and then go to, you know, either continue to serve or go in the backcourt. I don't see a lot of adjustment of tempo, which negates the ability to get grooved in and to roll out everything.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, I learned that from Dave. Dave was excellent at that. You know, Dave was able to play a power game and a control game. And if you like the power, he wasn't going to give you that. You were going to get everything slow and deep and just drive you crazy. Whereas, you know, if he played somebody that he needed to have the power with, he had that as well, and he would adjust to that. So, you know, as a junior playing with Dave a lot, that was one thing that I definitely was able to incorporate into my game, and that he taught me was you got to have both. You got to be able to play two or three game styles within a match, depending on who you're playing and at what point in the match you're at. And I think that's, you know, if you ever watch Dave play and me as well, I mean, our games were very diversified in the sense that, you know, we could play the slow games and we could play the power games. And then, of course, we had our own games that we played too. But, I think that's a good point that Dave raises, because you do, when you watch the matches today, there's just a lot of power and then more power, and you don't see a lot of finesse. But I think of all the players that I've seen, I think Kane can play that finesse slower yep. game too, even though that's not really his strength. But he can, when I say it's not his strength, he wins more points easily by playing power game.
Yeah.
But he can play both.
Yeah.
But and for Kane, it's a change of pace. It's the ability to negate those things the best he can, you know. And so, you know, it's just interesting to me. And what Greg said is these guys just run up and hit and go from there. You know, they don't understand. A lot of these guys that I see don't understand the game itself, i.e., if somebody loves to hit a splat shot, what's the counter to the splat? You know, you take it out towards 4 to 5 feet out on the court. You negate it with a good ceiling or something that is up here or drives into their body. And, you know, how do you negate those things? How do you adjust? And that's a function of understanding the game versus just walking up and hitting it. And, okay, I think I'm going to hit a pinch. Well, okay, I think I'm going to go down. You know, what's the strategy behind it? Mm-hmm. And I just see the players that I see, I haven't seen that much of that type of action.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I'm curious, as, you know, a couple of people with a ton of coaching experience, how would you go about teaching a player to attack Kane?
Well, for me, I would just say that, you know, first of all, his serve is so good that the number one thing you have to do is counter his serve. And that is always going to be a challenge because it's so good. But once you get past that, it's a lot about shot selection. And, you know, Kane is so good in the front court that my goal would be for him to hit 90% or more shots from three quarters court or further back. And so, so what that means is, I mean, okay, if he's going to beat me, I'm going to have him beat me from 38 feet and not from, you know, 20 feet from the front. Cause you know, he's going to own that. He's going to win that battle. So, you know, serve returns, if you can get him out of the middle, get him moving, and then shot selection, you know, you got to play a lot of lines and a lot of wide angle passes again to keep him deep. And, you know, I think that Kane really doesn't, I just don't see that he has any true weakness that you could say, well, you know, if I just served it to his forehand, you know, a lob serve to his forehand. No, I mean, he's got the entire package. And I think is that the entire package, you can't just groove into one type of way to play him. Like Dave was saying, you know, you've got to make adjustments all throughout the match because Kane's good enough. If all you're doing is hitting lines and cross courts, Kane's going to take two or three steps back on you. So, you know, so you got at that point, that's when you got to pinch it. But anyway, I just think in general, just as a general answer to your question, Dylan, I would force Kane to hit more shots from three quarters court and back. So that really means lines and cross courts and angles that kick deep into the back court and don't really come off the back wall. Would you agree with that, Dave?
Yeah, totally. And applying maximum pressure via retrieving and things like that to where, you know, what I see are these players that have acquiesced to the fact that they're going to be second. And so in their body language and everything they do against Kane, except on the occasion, they're satisfied with being second. And one of the things that we in particular, Greg and both Greg and me, we weren't satisfied with being second. Okay. With Hogan, for example, Hogan had the same genre that Kane had. Okay. Hogan, you know, nobody's going to beat Hogan. And the answer is you got to get that out of your mind, and you got to attack that premise via what is the weakness, what's the strength, isolate on the weakness and work from there. When we beat Hogan, everybody was afraid of Hogan. Everybody was playing for second. And you can't accept that premise, and then you have to do the things that get you to the point where you can execute under maximum pressure and retrieve under maximum pressure and be the more conditioned, more polished player. Just that simple.
Dylan, I would say one other thing about Kane, and I would give him tons of credit for this, is that, you know, as I've watched him over the, I would say, the last 10 years, I mean, you know, to his credit, whatever was a weakness 10 years ago was not a weakness nine years ago. In other words, he's fixed any weaknesses he may have had. He's worked on them, and he no longer really has a true weakness.
Yeah,
he's a complete player. I mean, he's always going to be the ultimate test of how to beat him, how to beat somebody in racquetball. I mean, he just is, because he's got the complete
really good game.
Yeah. So anyway, enough of that. But
yeah,
I did want to say that, because it's not that easy that you have a way to play him in a way that you think you can beat him, because he is improving every year and getting better as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So
I will tell you this though, if there was a way to go back in time to get to be about 21, 22, I'd love a shot at him.
Yeah, if only. Yeah.
Yeah, if only. It, you know, and it's easier said than done, I know, but I think it would be a blast. Knowing what I know, I would love it. It'd be so much fun.
Yeah, and that's a great mindset to have, especially given that I agree with you, where it often looks like people are satisfied with seconds.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's you know, you either understand that second place is first loser, and don't be satisfied with that, or you acquiesce to, hey, I'm just going to be okay, and you know, and two, being second is good, don't get me wrong, but being number one is the best, and that's what, as a competitor, you need to strive for, you know, and that's what we strive for, you know, so.
Great. So I wanted to get back into you guys and what your playing was like growing up. So what was your relationship like, given that you were both super competitive and both super amazing players?
let me start with this, Greg, because this was a Greg is 7 years younger than I am. Okay, so go to the YMCA, and Greg would hang with me, and I'm working out trying to get better, right? I'm probably a low open player at the time. And I'd say to him, he goes, can I play you guys? I go, no, you go over and practice. You got to get better first. And you're not good enough yet. And so he'd go in there and practice. And you know, then he'd start getting to the point where he's gotten better and better. And then we'd have these tournaments. And I'd be, you know, I started off as a club pro, okay, teaching pro, okay. So we'd run tournaments and stuff like that. And then I'd set it up in the tournament where Greg would have the hardest draw of anybody. But I would put, you know, and in these days, you had sponsors that wanted to give you prizes and things like that. So I'd sit there and put a stereo system as first place in B division. And Greg was a B player, right? And so Greg would sit there and you know, go play these things. And he'd play, I'd put him against the hardest players in the club and stuff like that. And next thing you know, he's getting that, remember that stereo system you wanted at the club?
Yeah, you would think my brother's the tournament director, I'd get the easiest draw. I got the hardest draw of all.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what made them, you know, strive to continue to be better and do these things. And then from a playing side, one of the things that I did with Greg is when we stepped on the court, he wasn't my brother. He was a competitor. And so what I did to him is there was nothing that any player could do to Greg that would affect him whatsoever because of the things that I did. I'd knock him around. I'd talk to him. I'd hit him with the ball, whatever. And it was a way to prep him to play professionally. So when he was 16, 17 playing these pro stops, you know, he wasn't too fazed by any of the stuff the guys did because we did it all in practice. And we would sit there, and this was in El Paso, and we would battle. And we'd have another guy, Joe Wentbrink, who's a buddy of ours, that would play, and we'd do the one in, one out. And it was just, you know, we're playing for the
it was a battle.
The Coca-Colas, right? And it was just a full-out two and a half hour just getting after it, full bore and full intensity, so that when we got to tournaments, we were prepped and ready to go.
Hey, Dylan, if someone didn't break a racket, it just wasn't a good practice session.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was intense. It was intense, and that's the way to practice.
I heard a rumor that there were broken doors.
Yeah, there were.
All right.
I have to tell that story, David. It's hysterical. So somehow at the club that we played at, there were two glass back wall courts that were exhibition courts. And that's normally where we played. But for some reason, we were on one of the side courts. And it had kind of just a regular type door.
A wooden door.
Wooden, you know, good sized door, right? So we're playing and I am playing good. And Dave is going absolutely crazy because I'm beating the crud out of him. So after a couple of games, he just can't stand it anymore. He's in the back court, and he takes his foot and kind of donkey kicks the door to the court. Next thing you know, the thing is, I mean, he kicked it two or three good ones. Next thing you know, the door has fallen off the hinges. I mean, he has kicked the door off the hinges. So of course we quickly change courts. Dave props the door up. We go to another court and finish our match. Well, so it took like, I don't know, it took like maybe a week for that door to get fixed. So, I mean, literally the next day after that door had been fixed, we're on a similar side court for some reason. And Dave kicks the door on the other court that we were playing on, because he's so ticked off that he's cheap doors.
Right.
Yeah, Dave said they were cheap doors. So Dylan, he kicks the door, and that door comes off the hinge. So we end up having to move courts, and we end up on the glass court. And we're trying to finish out our workout, and the general manager of the club, a guy named Mike Chandler, who's friends of ours. He saw that Dave had kicked the other door off, and he came and he was at the top of the court yelling down into the court. Him and Dave were yelling at each other for about 4 minutes because Mike was so mad that Dave had kicked the second door. He's like, he's yelling at him, and we're going to take this out of your paycheck. it was just greatness, but it really just really puts a frame on the fact of how intense our every day. That wasn't, you know, every other one. I'm not saying Dave kicked doors down every time, but I mean, I'm talking about high intensity, you know, 2 hour practice sessions every day. And then, you know, Dave was talking about how, you know, I had to work to get where I could play with him and Joe and some of the other guys that were the better players. But then what happened is I got where I was good enough that I was the second best on the court behind Dave. And then it got where, you know, I could push Dave. And then all of a sudden, you know, we were starting to split matches and split games. And so once it got to that level of intensity, you know, not only was he pushing me like he had been doing the whole time, but now I was pushing him back.
Yeah.
So it got where, you know, it would help him to play me too.
Great. And what did, at the peak of when you were working your hardest at the professional level, what did that conditioning program look like?
Oh man, we'd sit there. A couple things. We'd sit there and play lots of racquetball, but also we'd do these practice drills. So we'd play ball, but then at night we'd do our practice drills where you'd sit there and go hit forehands, backhands, and you know, so on and so forth. Lots of them, okay. And then we would also, Greg and I were one of the first two racquetball players to do the weight training. So we'd go, and one of the guys that owned the Nautilus there in town, which is a fitness center, a weightlifting center, was Gil Reyes. And Gil, you know, he would train us and kick our butts on the weights and stuff like that. You might recall his name because Gil is the one that he ended up going to Las Vegas and training UNLV football players. And then the next person he started training was Andre Agassi. And so he would just kick our butts. And so when you have that level of pain from working out hard, you're playing racquetball, and the racquetball was easy. So when we were playing tournaments, what got to the point where we were so conditioned, so strong, that we would not be fatigued at all in really, really tough matches. And, you know, if all else is equal, the more conditioned athlete wins, right? And so that was our motto, and we worked hard and trained hard so that instead of losing because of fatigue, we'd win because we're better conditioned ball players.
Yeah. What were some specifics of what was involved with that program?
One was on the Nautilus weightlifting piece of the equation. Then we'd go do, we had one of the guys that was helping us, we'd do bound. Remember the bounding and stuff, Greg?
So yeah, Dylan, one of the things that I really started doing a lot of, and then Dave kind of saw that it was working and jumped in on it too, was plyometrics. You know, a lot of bounding, a lot of, you know, toe taps and jump ropes and those types of things that help your explosiveness. You know, in today's world, you see the box jumps. You know, you see a lot of that. It was basically our version of that.
Awesome. So do you guys have a favorite win from your entire career?
I do. You want me to go first, Dave?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, for me, you know, I mean, I in 85, I played Cliff in the finals of the Ectelon Nationals, which was televised on ESPN, and Cliff beat me in a tiebreaker. So I was super bummed about that. But then the next tournament following that was the DP Nationals. And that was really the big tournament from a prize money standpoint. I think first place was like 35,000 or, you know, 25,000, something like that. So that was really the most important tournament of the year, even though the Ectelon Nationals was on TV. That was important too. So my most proud moment was the fact that I lost in the Ectelon Nationals and then like 3 or 4 weeks later came back and won the DP Nationals that were in Boston. And to win that tournament, I beat Andy Roberts in the quarters, Hogan in the semis, and Mike Yellen in the finals. So, I mean, that was a pretty good sweep of players and just a good comeback for me and the biggest win of my career. So that'll always stand out to me. Dave?
And for me, it was the Ectelon Nationals when I beat Yellen, beat the hell out of Yellen in the finals, and which kicked me into the number one slot, professional player slot. And then I held on to that. All the, you know, we had the, I guess it was the DP Nationals after that, and lost Hogan in the finals, but I won two out of the three Nationals that year. And that was what kicked me into the number one in terms of total points and stuff like that. So, and it was fun. It was fun beating Yellen, but also kicking into that number one slot.
That's great. So do you guys have a certain trait that you think, a trait or something that you developed that you think allowed you to be as dominant as you were?
You know, for me, very simply, I am just such a great sport when I win. Okay, I'm really good. But I am really, really don't like losing. Okay. And you know, I call it the beast, okay? Because in the business world, you got to sort of control that. Greg has always been a lot calmer. He's intense, but he's more of that controlled rage, whereas mine was a really, really, really didn't like losing, and it really made me angry when I lost, and it bugged me intensely when I lost to people.
Yeah.
So for me, Dylan, I don't know. Do you want to follow up with Dave on that, or do you want me to jump in?
Yeah, I actually had a question. So for me, I relate in a sense to being not a great loser. And I'm wondering, how do you kind of reconcile being mentally tough when you're within a match and you're losing or you're struggling and not getting upset at that time, right? Not letting it affect you within a match, because I found that to be, at least for me, an issue.
That's a great question. And very simply put, if you know what you're doing, you stay in the now. And what that means is during the match, I wouldn't sit there and think about winning or losing. What I'm concentrating on doing is moving my feet. Whatever the shot is, hitting the ball square, fall through, get in position. What's my opponent's position? What's the best serve? What's the best service return? What's their position when they hit a drive serve to my back end? What's their position afterwards? So this is one of the most critical things that can be taught to competitors, okay? You listen to all the different sports, and if you pay attention to this, when these athletes, great athletes, are on doing their thing, you'll hear them always talking about staying in the now. You know, I just looked up and the basket was there, and I shot and followed through, whatever it is. If you pay attention, and I've been paying attention since for a long, long time on this stuff, that is the most critical thing to being a competitor. And that's, you know, when I coach staying in the now through analytics. I coach my kids football, basketball, baseball stuff. And the number one thing I try to get the kids to do is focus on mechanics and staying in the now. That is absolutely critical.
Awesome. Greg, so what was the trait or skill that you developed that you think allowed you to be so successful?
Well, I think I was talking about this with Charlie Brumfield at his birthday a couple weeks ago in San Diego. The biggest thing for me was, and what made me successful was my ability to. I was a combination of four or five players, I think. And, you know, it all started with Dave and how he taught me my stroke mechanics and shot selection and those types of things. But then I, you know, because I watched Dave go through the ranks as a pro as I was a junior. So I watched a ton of matches, not only his, but other players too. And so what I found that I would do is I would incorporate things from four or five different players. So, you know, I looked at how Marty used his power as an asset and, you know, what he would do in certain situations to maximize his capabilities because of his power. You know, I used my height to work in a backhand splat into my repertoire that you know, like a guy like Jim Heiser has told me. He said, Greg, your backhand splat changed the game, because those ceiling balls to the left side that used to be a perfect defensive shot, you would turn into an offensive part of the game, which is true. I did that. I incorporated that into my game. And, you know, so I look at myself and I'm like a combination of Dave, Marty Hogan, Mike Yellen. And then, you know, of course I'd see Jerry Halesher and his competitiveness. And so that's how I really, you know, my base was started with Dave and how he taught me proper stroke mechanics and those types of things. And then, you know, the thing that kind of put me over the hump was, you know, being 6'2", my fitness level had to become an asset, because what was happening and why I was losing was I would start to fatigue out against the top players. Then my feet would stop moving. And then I'd start missing shots and I would lose. And you still see that today. I've watched some matches recently that I just saw. I saw players fade off and I would do that. So that was really the last the last thing that I had to do was take all that that I'd incorporated into and then become extremely fit.
Yeah. What, and as a follow-up to that, when Greg was 14, 15, whatever, I forget what it was, I had to work and he went up to a tournament, pro stop in Tucson. And so he'd sneak in to watch the pros play and he'd watch all this stuff. And he would sit there and he would come back and go, "Hey, I think I have this new shot I've been practicing." And that was the splat, right? And so he'd sit there and watch these for hours. I mean, he'd watch all the pro players and pick up all the nuances from these pro matches, positives and negatives, and work them into his game on a positive structure. I remember distinctly he goes, "Hey, I got this new shot. Wait till you see it." You know, and it, and he built the all these different shots into his repertoire.
Awesome. I think as brothers, you guys had the unique relationship where you coached each other and were both pros at the same time. What was that like, kind of coaching each other, and how much satisfaction did you get from each other, you know, carrying the other through a win?
Well, for me, one of the coolest things was that, you know, Dave and I were so close that you kind of, I knew what he was thinking on the court and vice versa. So, you know, we could kind of, it sounds weird, but I mean, just we could kind of look at each other and know, okay, this is what he kind of means by that look. Or, you know, you could tell, okay, now would be a good time for a timeout, because I can tell, you know, Dave's lost like 3 or 4 points. He's not, you know, he's not in his groove right now. And, you know, he'd kind of look at me and I'd just give him the tee for, "Hey, let's get a timeout." And, you know, I just think that was really big. And the inside the game coaching, you know, being able to come off the court and talk to someone who's the number one or two player in the world, who knows you, you know, like a brother, obviously. And so we would always have some really good, just, you know, heart to heart conversations about what's going on in the match. And so we could make adjustments that way. And I think that was really cool for me.
Yeah. And as a follow up on that, you know, we'd sit there and go, "Okay, Greg, on your serve, you try this. He's stepping over to cover your drive serve to the left. I want you to hit one down to the right. That'll negate that and get him back to neutral. Service return, he's playing a deep left zone. You can pinch or go cross court kill." You know, things like that, where outside the court you can see some of the adjustments other players are making, and then you can share that information. You know, I could share that with Greg and vice versa, to where, you know, when you're playing 11-point games, if you can garner 3 to 4 points just by making adjustments, you're ahead of the game, right? And then also the tempo, like what Greg said about, hey, if you're out of sync, hey, this is a good time to call a timeout, you know, and do those kind of things. And then, you know, you always knew that that you know, Greg or you know, either one of us was in trouble when we'd look and go, "What serve?" You know, because that's when, right? Because you're going. Yeah. Because you're not, that tells you that you're, when you're playing ball, your mind is working, and you know, it's the inner self saying, "Okay, I'm going to go drive serve to the right. Okay, let me change it up, lob, nick." You know, there's an inner conversation going on if you're doing the analytics, right? And sometimes if things aren't working the right way, those analytics are going, WTF, what should I do here? And that's when it was good to be able to go to Greg and, you know, and call a timeout and say, "Hey, what serve?" And that is historically, you know, when Greg knew that I was out of sync or vice versa, and then we go, okay. And by the way, this goes with the junior players that we taught. It was consistent. When they come out and somebody goes, "What serve?" That tells you that the inner conversation isn't going as well as expected. You get them on track, and then the next thing you know, and by getting them on track, you talk about, okay, here, drive serve to the right, make sure you hit the ball square. You know, on your shot selection, they're playing a deep zone. You know, when you have your backhand, they're leaning over to the right, take it down the line, whatever it is, right? So that's all goes back to staying in the now and getting them back focused on the game itself and executing, okay, versus results-oriented thinking.
Dylan, I think one of the other things, too, just as an asset to, you know, having your brother there is from a travel perspective, you know, you're on the road a bunch. And, you know, it's nice to be with a familiar face. You've been on the road for 6 out of the last 8 weeks, and you're traveling with your brother, and it just makes it easier to be away and travel. And so that was definitely a perk, I think, was just the ability to, you know, you're not stuck in a city by yourself waiting for your next match. You're with your brother, you go eat, you know, we go see a movie or whatever. It's a comfortable feeling. Obviously you're with family, so it made being on the road easier most of the time, unless it was, you know, going to the airport with Dave frantically, you know, 20 minutes before the flight trying to check your luggage. But we won't go down, we won't speak about that.
And in those days we had between 16 and 20 events. So we played, you know, from September on a lot of racquetball events. And so, you know, that made it nice to travel together and, you know, out of El Paso and then eventually out of Austin. It worked out very nicely. And you know, and we'd sit there and Greg and I would go get dinner. And then, you know, we'd have the guys come in. We'd have Halasier come into Austin or to El Paso. Conehead, Doug Cohen, a bunch of different – Colton. Ben Hameen, you know, these guys would come in, we'd work out and during the summer and play some ball. And then, you know, then when we were on the road, there were guys that we hung out with, including, you know, Greg and I hung out, but then other guys that made it really nice.
Awesome. And you've alluded to it a little bit already, but I wanted to ask, what are your favorite stories throughout your years in the sport?
My favorite story is actually, I was playing Hogan in the finals in Baltimore, and Toyota was the sponsor and they were giving away a truck. And so I'm playing Marty and we're in the second game. I won the first and it's pretty heated, you know, it's 5-all, 6-all kind of thing. And a baby in the crowd starts crying and, you know, we're both trying to ignore it. We play a point and, you know, in between points, the baby's just getting louder and louder. And by about the third or fourth point, I mean, this baby is full out crying. I'm talking infant crying. And Marty looks at the ref and he says, "Can someone get Halasier out of here?" And I mean, it just caught me. I mean, the crowd was laughing. I was laughing. He was laughing. And I mean, it really, we were laughing for about a minute and a half. And then Dave, I'll let you tell the story. The other good story that I love is Dave and Jerry Halasier always had a competition from the club to the hotel or from the club to the restaurant where we were going to eat. And it was always a race to see who would get there. But Dave, I'll let you tell the story.
So we're in Atlanta and this is absolutely the truth. So we're trying to get back. And this was one of Halasier's best moves. And so he's in the right-hand lane, and this is on one of the – it wasn't in a neighborhood. It was on a main road. We hit the stop sign, and I think Jerry was behind somebody. So I was in front. He had a person in front of him. Next thing you know, he and there's a little berm on the side there. So he decides – he's in a rental car, right? He jumps the curb, goes over the berm, hauls ass – he didn't go through the light because he went over the berm, right? Hops back on the road and beats us back to the hotel, no problem. It was one of the best moves ever as far as this kind of.
And we're talking about, it was somebody's front yard on a main road.
Yeah, but berm.
And Jerry was so happy to beat us to the restaurant. Anyway, there was a lot of that, and it was just crazy. You know, every time we'd get in a car and if Jerry was around, it was a race.
Yeah. You can't even be too mad about that losing in that way.
It was the greatest car move of all time.
Yeah, it was really good. It was really good. So, you know, there's all sorts of things that on the road with, you know, guys, the thing that you should be picking up is that though we were competed hard, not, you know, Greg and I competed hard against everybody. There's a respect and a camaraderie that you have with some of the players based on that. Some of the other players, you just want to beat the hell out of them anytime you can, whether on the court or off the court, because they're just a-holes, you know. And so you just, you know, but there's a bunch of good ones, and there's some of them that just sort of a pain in the tuchus, and you just got to ignore those and beat them, you know.
Yeah. I get the sense, and I'm not sure if this is the case or not, that you guys engaged in trash talking from time to time. Is that true?
Key point.
Yeah.
Trash talking, and dependent on who you're playing.
Yeah.
So when you step on the court, and this is, you know, Greg and I teach this, when you step on the court, everything you do on the court should have a purpose, okay? It should have a purpose. And so if you're going to trash talk or do something, what's the purpose in doing it? Is it to disconnect their computer in terms of the concentration level? Or what do you do on that? So there's, if you trash talk somebody that gets in, like, for example, with a Cliff Swain, you trash talk Cliff, it brings him up. It fires him up. You trash talk Greg, it brings him up. You trash talk me, it brought us up. So you pick and choose what you did to certain players based on, does it disconnect their computer, the computer being their mind, or does it help them? You know, if you're a jerk on the court, does it help them? Or if you're really nice to them, does it mellow them out, calm them down, and through your tactic, create an advantage for you as far as stuff goes? And that's the stuff we're talking about with the players today. I just don't know if a lot of them think in that those terms, you know, and I don't know, you know, they're a bunch of really nice and good ball players, but to what degree do they understand all facets of the game? And that means the mental and physical, and the mental being not only the focal point in terms of understanding how to adjust when you're playing the game, but also how to take a player out of their game, okay? And, you know, for me, I'd sit there, you know, Mike Yellen, who's a great ball player, Mike and I played for the same company, heated competition, not only when we played, but also with the company. I'd sit there and I'd talk, you know, Mike would sit there and you know, mumble something to the ref about getting a bad call and trying to, you know, get all this stuff. And I'd sit there and go, "What's wrong, Mikey? What's wrong, Mikey? You want some more milk, Mikey?" And he would just explode. And it wasn't because I was trying to be mean to Mike. What I was trying to do is get him so angry at me that he wasn't concentrating on the game. Just that simple, you know. And people would laugh. And, you know, here's trying to be really, you know, this super tough mental guy. And his head would pop off, you know. And that's, if you can do that, you're ahead of the game. That's the mental piece of the game. And it was nothing against Mike whatsoever. He's a great champion. I mean, he's four-time number one player in the world. He's great. But how do you beat people? If you disconnect their brain or the computer, everything else goes, right?
Yeah.
And Dylan, for me, it was really, you know, I think a lot of it is also personality. So, like, for Dave, you know, some of the examples he was talking about, you know, he would also fire himself up by saying that kind of stuff. Whereas for me, you know, the more I got into that kind of talking, and it took away from my concentration. Yeah. And so, you know, it's just two different personality types. And for me, I was a little bit quieter and more, you know, just more thinking about my game than anything else. So, you know, of course, when Dave and I practiced together, you know, it got heated and there was a lot of conversation and that type of thing. And there were many times where he took me out of my game and I took him out of his game. But typically in tournaments, for me, the way I could, you know, stay focused and play the best was very, very little talking.
Totally. So, As super high level coaches, both of you, Dave, you coached Cliff Swain, you coached Greg, obviously, you coached Mike Guidry, And Greg, you've been a coach of the junior team. What, looking at sort of the pro landscape today, and a lot of players are now trying to make the leap. There are a lot of younger players trying to get to the top spot, really, especially now with Kane potentially being out. What is maybe the biggest piece of advice that you would give these guys?
One, if Kane's specifically out, I would contend those players need to want Kane to be in it to beat him. That's one. Two, the advice I would suggest on all these players is if you can hit the ball where you hit it, whenever you want to hit it there, you're going to win. And you have to understand stroke mechanics, the overall game. If you understand all facets of the game, not only physically but mentally, you're going to be successful if you train and condition and work hard at your sport. It's just that simple. And if you don't have the proper mechanics, you're going to hit a plateau. If somebody's coaching you and they go, hey, hit it down the line, but you don't understand how to hit it down the line, what it takes to hit a backhand down the line, then what good does it do strategy if you can't execute? So it's really mechanics. You gotta be able to hit the ball where you want it. And if you can't do that, then you're going to plateau out and you're only going to get to a certain level.
Yeah.
And I see that in the current pro tour, where there's players that have a favorite shot that they can only hit that favorite shot. You know what my favorite shot is? The shot that wins the point. It's not a forehand, it's not a backhand, it's not a pinch, it's not a splat. It's what's going to win me the point. Whereas some of these other players, they just, hey, if you're up front middle, they're going to splat it. Why? Because they can't hit any other shot.
Yeah. Are there any common mechanical errors you see even at that level? Or one specific that comes to mind that's particularly common?
Yeah, well, I see quite a few vertical strokes where the top of the racket comes down. Okay, so with a vertical stroke where the racket comes down, one, the elbow movement on the backhand's down, or the elbow movement in the forehand side is into the body. And two, if you hit it perfectly, it's going to be a good shot. But if it's maybe a little out in front of your power zone, it goes up. Or if it's behind your power zone, it skips. And so from a mechanical side, if we recognize, Greg and I recognize, we're playing somebody with a vertical stroke, what we do is we angle the shots in such a way that it comes behind the power zone. They swing down. They skip the ball. They get mad at skipping it and go, man, I just didn't play well. And we just wink, wink, and win the match. So I see a lot of that. I see a lot of shoulder rotation. I see a lot of bending over from the waist. I see a lot of inverted elbows and elbows coming back that when they get older, they're going to have a bad shoulder. I see more mechanical errors out there than you can shake a stick at in terms of errors. And don't get me wrong, they hit the ball well, but they plateau out, because they don't understand how to do things. What's the extension speed? Where's the contact point on a pinch? These kind of things, to where you just don't see that type of degree of depth in their understanding of the game.
And Dylan, what I would just add to what Dave said is, because what Dave said is absolutely right, but then what that turns into is, and what I'm going to say and kind of focus on is that I see the shot selection is very poor, and it's very reactive, and it's very, I'm going to hit it. The ball is dictating to the player where they're going to have to hit the shot. And I think that's one of the biggest things I see at the top level of racquetball, is that the shot selection is very weak in terms of the what they're selecting to try to hit. Instead of going down the line and cross courts, they're hitting sidewall, front wall, and the ball sits up for their competition. And if you watch, I was telling somebody this, I was telling Jim Winterton this the other day when I was talking to him, that I really think that of all the players I've ever watched, Kane's shot selection is incredible. Now, I think three quarters of the time his serve is so good that it's put his next shot at a, you know, as a winner. And so he's earned that next shot. But even so, I mean, I rarely see him take a bad shot. And if he loses a point because he skipped a ball or something like that, he was hitting the right shot, but he just missed it. You know, you just don't see him hit a lot of shots where you go, that was, why would he ever try that? I mean, he's hitting the ball, he's hitting the lines, he's hitting cross courts, and then when he's got the player behind him, he's going to the corner. And I mean, a lot of times too, it's reactive shots that, you know, you don't have a whole lot of time to think about, and he's hitting the right shot 99.9% of the time. So, you know, for me in this workshop that I'm working with these players coming up in Malibu, June 9th through the 11th, you know, that's one thing I'm going to work on is, you know, as Dave said, you know, it's got to be, you got to have the right stroke mechanics, but you also have to be hitting the right shots. But there's times where you can't, if you don't have the right stroke mechanics, you can't hit the right shot. And so it's a combination of those two things that, you know, I'll be working on with these pro players in the IRT workshop.
Well, and these guys, to Greg's point too, is you ask Kane what his favorite shot is, and he might say something, but it's you know, I've seen him adjust, and he doesn't hit the same shot. If the player is adjusting to his shot selection, he absolutely adjusts to that. Swain is also excellent at it. Cliff is dynamite on that. I watched Cliff dismantle Kane in his prime because he had equal power on serve, and he had that mano-a-mano attitude, and he would adjust his shots accordingly. So it really gets back to those things that make all the difference in the world, whether you're going to whether you're going to be satisfied with being first runner-up, you know. And that's where these guys really have to, you know, are they taking their craft seriously? In our day, we took it seriously because, you know, one, there was a tough competition. Two, you could make some pretty good dough. You know, it's not every day that, you know, you get to walk into the Nike, you know, warehouse, pick up all the Nike shoes you want. They send us checks every month. You got huge bonuses on that front. I mean, you know, got Sports Illustrated articles on that front. You know, just all these things, posters, you know. I was lucky to be the first Nike poster with Heather Mackay, one of the greatest squash players ever, on the racquetball side. And Greg had his poster. And my point being is if you're going to be serious about it, get serious. Don't do it halfway. And that means all facets. You got to understand every piece of the equation. And a lot of these, whether it's male or female, they don't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I want to be respectful of you guys' time. I really appreciate you guys coming on. This is a great conversation, and I feel like I learned a ton that I'm going to go back and apply. Is there anything you'd like to leave the racquetball community with? Any parting thoughts?
Go ahead, Greg.
Swing hard in case you hit it.
I like it.
Oh, that's great. On my end, it's and this is on a serious note, we have to go into the clubs as club pros and start generating a professional programming to be able to build our sport back up. And what's happened in meetings I talked about years back about our competitors were the fitness industry taking our courts away. We have to, as club pros, we got to come in and start showing the ability to run programs, make money for these facilities, get players playing. And, you know, that's the only way we're going to make racquetball great again. It has to be grassroots, and it's about the economics in the club. You know, Greg and I had owned a athletic facility and we had 10 courts as well as the other amenities, we would make a killing on the racquetball because we would program the living bejesus out of it. And that's what we have to do as a community if we want to make this sport. We are going to the place of handball if we're not careful. And that's where, you know, these club pros coming in and teaching and really getting people involved in the sport is really critical. So thank you for your time. I didn't mean to belabor that point, but it's very important that we get these at grassroots, that we show these club owners that through racquetball attrition is down and that they can make money on our sport via the club pros.
Great. Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on, guys. Really appreciate it.
Okay, man.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
The Racquetball Show is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, vegetarians, and racquetball players get lower rates on their life insurance. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people. Health IQ can save customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. Like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. To see if you qualify, to learn more, or to get a free quote on life insurance, you can visit healthiq.com/TRS. Link in the podcast description. This is a great way of supporting the podcast and of potentially getting great savings on your life insurance. Check them out. Thank you for tuning in to episode 13 of the Racquetball Show podcast. As always, if you want to reach out to me, you can reach me at dylan@racquetballshow.com. That's DYLAN@racquetballshow.com. And thank you so much for listening.